From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It would be tempting to think our attitudes about suicide these days are somehow more nuanced or more sophisticated than they were in the past. But the scholar Margaret Batten says that's missing an important point about the story of suicide. Throughout human history, she says, people and cultures have been all over the map about what they think of someone ending their own life. At times, religions saw suicide as noble or at least understandable. At other times, it was seen as an unspeakable sin. Batten says knowing the varied history of these attitudes should be able to tell us something about the way we think of the ethics of suicide today. And that's what we're talking about with Margaret Batten. Buried in this conversation is just the most difficult question there is suicide wrong? Join us after the news. This week in Video West, see another in our series with Herta Saunders. Herta has agreed to share her journey with us. She's been diagnosed with a form of progressive dementia. And when the time is right, and everyone hopes that's years away, but when the time is right, Herta is going to take her own life. So she's thinking a lot about the criteria for a life worth living. Go see the film at videowest.org. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It's telling that suicide prevention groups around the country ask media organizations to give prevention hotline numbers and website addresses anytime they're talking about the subject of suicide. It's one of the reasons the philosophy professor Margaret Batten gives the number for the National Crisis Hotline when she talks about her latest book. We have a link to that number on our website. Batten's book is about the ethics of suicide. And to give you a sense of just how varied the attitudes are on this subject, consider the paper version of the book is more than 700 pages. There's also a digital version. Today in the program, our conversation with Margaret Batten, who is a distinguished professor of philosophy and an adjunct professor of internal medicine at the University of Utah. Her book is called The Ethics of Suicide, and she says the wide spectrum of views about ending one's own life are at the root of how we think about that subject today. We began our conversation about the caution that Batten takes when discussing the issue, which she says could be a trigger for some.
Some people think that a conversation can be a trigger. Other people think it's a really releasing to be able to talk about suicide. But you can't tell who's out there, who's listening, who's reading. Some of the texts in this book are quite inflammatory.
Yeah.
In both directions. Some would incite you to this. Others would denounce it as the most awful thing you could possibly do. But you don't know how readers will respond to that.
Right.
And it's such a, in a way, taboo topic that we shy away from talking about it.
Is it still taboo?
I think so. I think so. Maybe getting less taboo. But in a way, as the very notion of suicide, that label, becomes the property of objectors to right-to-die issues, that word becomes more and more negative. And the proponents adopt terms like aid in dying or self-deliverance and so on with neutral or favorable kinds of connotations.
But suicide is the bad way
suicide
of putting it for some
is
reason.
I think it's fair to say that the term suicide itself, the very word, evokes shivers.
Yeah.
A gut-wrenching reaction in at least some people. It's bad. It's a sin. It's a crime. It's been vilified, it's believed, for centuries. And it's something that's so completely misguided or wrong, people often assume that it should be prevented at all costs.
Well, and we'll come back to this a little bit later in the conversation, but also now, and as you write about in your book, in the 20th and 21st century, it's a pathology. Mm-hmm. So suicide is – it's almost as if – we can't talk about the ethical implications because it's so associated with mental illness and pathology. Mm-hmm. That was really an interesting section of the book.
I think it's, as a matter of historical development, it was regarded as a religious or ethical issue up until the time of Durkheim and Freud.
Freud, yeah.
And Durkheim held that it was a matter of social organization, what kind of society you were in and how well integrated you were or were not into the society. And for Freud, it's psychopathology. This view is being challenged in academic suicidology, but we tend to treat it as a matter of mental illness, especially depression. And so that makes it seem as though there's no reason for talking about ethics.
And individual responsibility.
Or individual responsibility or choice or responses to situations or realism or fear or any of those things, right?
Because it's a pathology. It's off limits in some way.
It's a pathology. It's off limits. Yeah. The person is sick. They need pity and treatment and prevention, but not to be taken seriously.
One of the questions beneath these many forms of suicide, and I'm sort of astounded at the range of cultural ideas and notions, and also that it's not a linear way of thinking, that we one day thought one way and now think one way. It seems like we go back and forth culturally, but you write this, you write one of these questions, the role that a person may play in his or her own death. Now, what is it that interests you about that question? You've been writing this about this for some time now. What interests you about this issue?
I think when I first started to think about this, there was almost nothing to read in current literature. It was assumed that we die at the end of the whatever illness we've contracted or whatever accident befalls us, and that we follow that illness out until its end, right? That to interrupt that progression or to take an active role in one's own dying just wasn't part of the picture. Now, there's some reasons for that. So we died more rapidly in earlier periods of history. There was less that physicians could do to extend one's life. There was way less in the way of modern technical medical apparatus for continuing. The modern picture of dying, that's true for many people, didn't exist. In much earlier periods, you fell seriously ill, became perhaps bedbound. And once you were bedbound, pneumonia was the immediate risk. No way to treat it, really. No antibiotics. And you'd be dead in a couple of days. It was known as the old man's friend. There's no old man's friend anymore.
So we have to think about these differently. We have to actually ponder all the ethical, philosophical questions at the heart of this now.
I think we need to think more clearly about how we each would want our deaths to go. We can't not have a death, right?
Yeah.
We all die. But how that occurs should, I think, be something that we are able to reflect on, able to steer, as it were, able to, often the term is negotiate the shoals of how dying goes, able to have a voice in, maybe even able to be the architect of how it goes.
Yeah.
Right.
Being
after
control.
All, it's my death, right? It's your death. There's one for everybody, right? Some aren't foreseen and some are too sudden to forestall, but the majority of people in the developed countries will die of deaths that have long downhill courses. So cancer, heart disease, and other kinds of organ failure. You get diagnosed typically months or even years in advance. And there are different trajectories. With cancer, one often stays in quite good shape until a steep drop-off. With organ failure, it fluctuates more widely. And the dementias, of course, are what they are.
Yeah.
But in all of those, you can predict what's likely to come.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean it'll happen for sure or happen that way, but we have increasingly good information about the prospects, the prognosis in each kind of these diseases. Now, why can't we think more clearly about how you want that to go.
And that's the question, though. Why? Because it's so fraught with so much history and so much baggage, mm-hmm. right? I mean, that's why we can't really have that conversation, or at least it's hard to separate ourselves from all that culture or the idea of ethics and morality.
Well, you could look at it in a slightly different way if we looked more carefully about the historical antecedents. We might find things in previous thinkers, both in Western culture and also in non-Western and even oral cultures, that make us see this issue differently.
Well, that's what's so interesting about the book, though, is that it's so interesting, the diverse range, as we were saying earlier, of thinking and such sophisticated ways of thinking it in ancient times, which I now sounds terrible for me to think. I can't imagine they were so progressive in the way they were thinking about suicide.
They all died too, right?
That's right.
Nothing else is as universal as this, right?
And we'll get to some of those.
So the early Greeks thought about it. The early Hebrews thought about it. The early Egyptians wrote poetry about it. The non-Western cultures, Hinduism, Buddhism, Jainism, Confucius, Islam, all those cultures have thought about this issue.
What do you think the ethical questions tell you about human nature? Does it give you any – I know it's all over the map, but has it told you something about human nature, like – here's a reductive conclusion, we're afraid of death, or we don't know what to do about death.
I think, actually, this might be the arena in which human nature is least uniform. Hmm. At least that's my guess. So, yes, there are accounts of deep fear of death, and there are accounts of deep fear, tremendous fear of death, whether or not there's a belief in some afterlife afterwards, and whether that afterlife is a positive one or a negative one, or whether you don't know which it's going to be, or whether there's no afterlife at all. People's emotional reactions to death vary, as far as I can see from these texts, all over the map, from embrace to absolutely paralyzing fear, right? And everything in between.
Yeah.
And from various kinds of conjecture, attempts to stave it off, attempts to bring it on, it's wildly different from one individual and also one culture to another.
Let's take Christianity, for example. What's really fascinating, on one hand, you write about the fact that and not throughout Christian tradition, but let's say in the 18th century American Christianity, they were pretty adamant about the fact that suicide was just straightforwardly evil.
Evil, profoundly evil.
Profoundly evil. But you don't have to go back that far to find Christians who would absolve themselves of sin and then commit suicide to get to heaven.
Right.
This
is pretty controversial in scholarship of early Christianity. But there's some evidence to think that that was the thinking, especially, for instance, in a group called the Circumcellions. This is a North African group. And the thinking went this way. Look, there's this wonderful heaven awaiting. To be free of sin is the way to gain entrance to heaven. So what must I do? The body, this reasoning went, the body is the locus of sin. As long as I stay in this body, I am at risk of sinning and continuing to sin. So what I should do is seek absolution from sin, kill myself, get rid of the body, and that will be the best way for me to increase my chances, assure myself of this glorious afterlife that my faith promises me. So that was the reasoning. It's claimed, as I say, this is controversial, but you can find passages, for instance, in Augustine that appear to respond to this kind of thinking.
Where he's trying to put an end to it?
Well, it's really by the time – so there was lots of debate in the early Christians about things like whether a virgin could – who was being about to be raped, typically by Roman soldiers, about to be raped could – kill herself to avoid being raped. Right? picture of rape, of course, was much different and a much bigger affront than we might think today. Could she kill herself to avoid rape? So the argument, some early thinkers thought yes, some early thinkers thought no. And the position that is really reached is one in which the argument is, well, she may leap from the tower but puts up with the fall. That was a way of – that was the, really the origins in a sense of the principle of double effect. Mm. She didn't aim to kill herself. She aimed only to get out of reach of the potential attacker. Now, whether you think that's plausible, that you could wish the leap and only put up with the fall
right.
is
– But it gets to intent, right?
It gets to intent.
Yeah.
So what is central? Is it the mechanism or is it the intent? And we go back and forth when we think about these things. So here's a case, and it makes a lot of difference in the way we label things. So here's an example. We take somebody who straps a bomb to himself and goes into a crowd and blows himself up. We call him a suicide bomber. Meanwhile, this is another somewhat hackneyed example, we take a soldier who falls on a grenade to save his buddy. We never call him a suicide.
No, we don't even call that suicide.
We don't call that suicide. We don't call him a suicide. And what do we call him? We call him a hero,
yeah.
Right? But he did the same act. He blew himself up knowingly, with foresight. We take the intentions to be different. But that's a case in which intentions are what's central and the actual action isn't.
Is that always the case where they're the intent?
No.
No.
Right? That's why the issues about end-of-life stuff, the aid in dying stuff are so different. So opponents point to the mechanism. The person swallows the pills. That's the mechanism. Instead of focusing on the intent, right? The intent is to end the suffering that's ongoing.
That's so legalistic, though. I mean, right? I mean, this idea of who cares who's pushing the plunger to give you an overdose of morphine to end your
mm-hmm.
life.
Mm-hmm.
But that seems to still matter to us.
Well, it matters to us in this country, the U.S., because that seems to be where we try to draw a bright line. In the Netherlands, both of those actions are legal and widely accepted. So whether it's the patient who administers the lethal drug or the doctor who administers the lethal drug isn't really of much importance. It's the intention and the reasons for which this is done, the action that's undertaken in order to avoid what's identified as intolerable suffering. Right? That's what's important. I think it's fair to say we're really confused about these things, or we're really of a whole variety of different minds about it, and we switch back and forth.
Yeah. That's Professor Margaret Pabst Batten. She teaches philosophy at the University of Utah. Her most recent book is The Ethics of Suicide, which is a collection of historical sources on the subject. There's also a digital archive of the book hosted by the Marriott Library at the University of Utah. We have a link to that on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a brief break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the Utah scholar Margaret Batten is our guest. We're talking about the subject she's explored for years now, the history and the ethics of suicide. Batten says the difficult questions about a person ending their own life have been with us for thousands of years. And she says looking at the history of these attitudes could teach us something about end-of-life issues today. You mentioned the idea of an afterlife. So we were talking about this Christian sect that thought mm-hmm. it could sort of clean itself up and then kill itself and get into heaven.
Mm-hmm.
Then we come to Cotton Mather, for example.
One of the most virulent of the early American divines.
Yeah.
Right.
What did he have to say about it? Because, again, we were talking earlier, but I think it's so interesting just how, as you say, adamant he was about it being a horrible sin, and I'm wondering how much of the remnants of that kind of thinking still exists in American Christianity, for example.
Well, I think it's tempting to go back to Luther and perhaps a little earlier, because by this time, this is early Protestantism, and it's Luther's view that suicide is caused by the devil.
Yeah.
Right? The devil invites you, tempts you, goads you into this act, which in the Christian tradition, clearly in place by the time of Augustine, as we were just saying, and solidified by Aquinas as wrong. But the notion that it's the devil that is impelling you to this wrong comes in at a somewhat later time.
Yeah.
And of course, here's an era in which mental illness isn't really treatable. We don't want to suppose that suicide is never associated with mental illness. It indeed can be. But the picture of someone driven into what we would call psychosis by the devil was a very robust part of his picture and accounts for, in Luther's view, suicide. That's how it happens. That continues on into many of the later Protestant divines. We don't talk about suicide that way anymore. We talk about mental illness. In many ways, we've retained the sort of causal sense. Mental illness caused this.
So that mental illness is the devil in this case.
Well, you might say that. Mental illness is the devil. It's true that someone with profound and serious mental illness may act in bizarre ways, may also suffer tremendously under these things. Not always true, but it can be true. Severe intractable depression is said to be awful.
Yeah.
Right. But currently we often simply label things mental illness. That allows us to put it in a certain box, that allows us to move in with across-the-board prevention. And in some ways it permits us to not listen to what that person's concerns are.
Mm. So, what effect does an afterlife, a belief in an afterlife, what role has that played over time? Has that been an aversion for people considering suicide, or has that necessarily been so?
So as we were talking, the presence of a beatific afterlife functioned as a lure, apparently, for some of the early Christians. That was an act of faith, in a sense, in order to
get there.
To get there.
Yeah.
By the time of Augustine and later Aquinas, the suicide is the preventative, the total roadblock.
Yeah.
Suicide keeps you from that beatific afterlife. It's the greatest sin. You can even track, for instance, the treatment of Judas in Christian thought. So in the earliest text, it looks as though Judas' suicide is an appropriate response to his betrayal of Jesus. He betrayed Jesus. He recognizes what he's done. Suicide is the appropriate response.
Right.
By the High Middle Ages, it's worse than the betrayal. That just shows you something about the evolution of this notion.
It's the greatest sin.
It's the greatest sin. Judaism appears to develop some of that in more or less in tandem.
Yeah, I found that interesting.
Right.
In tandem with Christianity, some of those ideas.
And, well, I mean, they're coexisting,
sure,
in many ways. Yeah. And Islam, which doesn't develop until after the time of Augustine, starts out of the box with a more substantial prohibition. It's not clearly in the Quran, but certainly in the Hadith.
So. What did the ancient Greeks think about suicide? I know, of course, it's pretty varied. I think one of the things that's interesting, and you write about Aristotle, who believed suicide was not a private matter, but it was a social one, that the idea of you ending your life did some damage to the greater state, I guess?
It's an insult to the state. You see that clearly in later English treatments of suicide, where the suicide, the person is the property of the king, and to end your life is to rob the king of his property, right? The penalties were extreme. And you see that idea it's hard to say it begins with Aristotle, but it's certainly there. It's an affront to the state. It's a wrong to the state. He also thought it was cowardly.
Yeah.
Aristotle has two paragraphs to devote to this topic.
Is that
whereas
it?
Plato has, you know, multiple.
Yeah.
Right?
And, what did Plato say?
Plato is quite interesting. Plato holds that suicide is wrong in some cases and not wrong or understandable in other cases. And it's a little different in different texts. Remember, Plato is the student of and chronicler of Socrates.
Yeah.
Socrates was ordered by the Athenian court to drink the hemlock.
Yeah.
Socrates could have kept himself from being convicted in the first place. And it's clear in Plato's account that he could easily have escaped from jail. His friends were ready with the bribes. The jailer had said he would take the bribe. And Socrates refused to do that and chose to drink the hemlock and so die. Was that a suicide? Was it not a suicide?
Gosh, it's so fascinating, too. I'm thinking about Mao and how Mao interpreted the suicide of a young peasant girl who did not want to go into an arranged
mm-hmm.
marriage
mm-hmm.
as not a suicide, but as a homicide
mm-hmm.
because she could have contributed to the revolutionary cause.
Right. It was the society that killed her, in his view.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
The sexism, the domination of women, the waste of women is really the way Mao thought about it, right? They waste half of the population. So that's a homicide, I guess is the right.
Yeah.
Another bizarre turn is John Donne.
Right.
John Donne.
This is almost the most interesting thing I found in the book, I have to say. Talk about this.
You must have read the whole thing, all 700 pages.
Yeah, right. Well, tell this story because I think it's utterly fascinating. And we should also make note of the fact that he did not say this when he was, at least publicly, when he was alive, actually, right?
He did write Via Thanatos, which is where this text is. But it was published after his death. He argues that suicide is only right if it's done for the glory of God. That's the only case in which it's morally or religiously permissible.
Yeah.
But there's one prime example of a suicide done for the glory of God. It's Jesus Christ. Well, you can imagine how controversial this was. No wonder he didn't publish it. But his argument is that Jesus, much like Socrates, that's not part of his argument. But
he could have gotten out of it.
Jesus could have gotten out of it, right? And that he willingly emitted his last breath. That Donne construes as a suicide. It's electively dying, but for a purpose, for a cause. It was for the glory of God, and that's what makes it not only permissible, but admirable. So again, what we see is the distinction between looking at the causal mechanical features of suicide and the intention under which it's done. So John Donne's analysis is clearly trades on the intention. It's good or admirable if it's done for the glory of God and not otherwise. Whereas many of our analyses trade on the mechanism, on the actual physical action.
Let's talk about one aspect of the thinking in Islam related to suicide, and that is this idea of martyrdom and jihad. How does that play into the big picture that you found?
Well, here's another case in which, in the first place, language makes a huge difference. So we've tended to label suicide things that we consider wrong or misguided or the product of mental illness, right? And we save terms like heroism or self-sacrifice or martyrdom for cases in which a person may have been causally responsible for their own death, but the motives are ones that we admire. So when we think about jihad, we note right away that suicide is regarded as strongly forbidden in Islam. It never calls its operatives suicide bombers. They're called martyrs, right? We call them suicide bombers because we regard them as acting under bad intentions and not worthy of respect.
Yeah.
We call the Japanese kamikaze suicide pilots. We say that they're on suicide missions.
Yeah.
And in fact, they did embark on one-way missions that they knew would lead to their deaths. But they're never called suicides in Japanese culture. They were heroes. They were cherry blossoms. They were martyrs for the cause of the nation. So that label suicide we use to label things that the culture, whatever culture we're in, regards as negative, and we never use it for our own heroes. There's some cases where we're a little confused. So take the self-immolations of social protesters, like the Buddhist monks and nuns protesting the Diem regime in Vietnam.
In Vietnam, yeah.
Are they suicides? Well, they did pour gasoline on themselves and light the match. On the other hand, we think of social protest as a worthy goal, right? And so what we call—
Fasting, for example, or hunger strikes.
Right? Hunger strikes, ending in death. Those we're a little ambivalent about what we call them because we see the mechanism of self-immolation, for example, is so conspicuous.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, the motives are so admirable, at least from this point of view.
I wonder, you write about Japanese culture, the Bushido military culture of honor,
right,
for example,
right.
A tradition, the kamikaze pilots you mentioned. There's a tradition apparently of love suicide.
Right.
What's distinctive about the way maybe the Japanese in particular, at least during a time anyway, thought about self-death?
Japanese culture, it's tempting to say, evolved with the notion that self-death could be heroic. It could be a matter, especially a matter of honor. Mm. Also, love suicides are a distinct trope in Japanese culture. Take our own culture where, for example, Daido kills herself for love. Lucretia kills herself to defend her honor. Those are all part of our culture, and they are recreated in later works. So it's not that these ideas are completely absent from our culture.
Right.
It's just that we haven't developed in Western culture a practice that involves self-death for reasons of love that is respected.
Why do you think?
I don't know how to answer that.
Huh.
Right. There is one practice in Western culture that still more or less survives that we understand as a social expectation that one should do what will end one's life. And that's the notion that the captain goes down with his ship.
Yeah.
Right?
That's still sort of expected, isn't it?
Right. It's still sort of expected. And when there are captains who don't do it,
we don't know what to make of that.
Often pointed out.
Yeah.
But it's that kind of social expectation that can operate within a culture. We don't have others that I'm aware of. But the fact that we even recognize that as an expectation, as a saying within our culture.
What did you find in indigenous cultures? Any consistent threads?
The indigenous cultures are quite challenging to explore because many of these cultures either didn't have written records or the written records didn't survive or couldn't be translated until much later. So think about who's out there. Well, they're the Aztec, the Maya, the Inca. They had practices that involved heart sacrifice, the Aztec, much of which was not voluntary, but some of which it was voluntary. It was a privilege for some. Take the Inuit groups, the Eskimo. There are those old stories about ice floes, but there are actually records of practices where self-caused death appeared to be socially accepted. This is sometimes called institutional suicide. where the cultural expectations shape how people behave. But they're enormously varied. Think about the African cultures. There were huge empires in Africa, some of which had practices involving many cultures had this, where the retinue of a king goes with him electively into the grave. You see those in Africa, in China, in Oceania, in the Scandinavian cultures to some extent. That was part of what you did,
yeah.
And you did it willingly, or at least that's what the records suggest. But, of course, the problem with them is that the reports come from Western observers. So
there's a filter there.
There's a filter, yeah. And it's, of course, a filter overlaid with all the negative stuff from Western culture.
That's Professor Margaret Pabst Batten. Her recent book is The Ethics of Suicide, Historical Sources. We have a link to a digital version of the book also on our website. Also, we should mention for those who have thoughts about suicide, there's a number for the National Crisis Hotline. It is 1-800-273-TALK. That's 273-8255. Today in Video West, we are premiering the second in a series of short films with Gerda Saunders of Salt Lake City. Gerda has been diagnosed with a form of progressive dementia. And in the film, she talks about her own plans for an assisted suicide. The film is called The Body That Is Left, and you can see it at videowest.org. We'll take another break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with Margaret Batten. She's a distinguished professor of philosophy at the University of Utah. Her book is The Ethics of Suicide. There's a section on Thomas Jefferson. There's
yes.
a section on John Adams. Can we talk a little bit about
absolutely.
The way they were thinking and writing about suicide?
Uh-huh. So Jefferson writes a letter. This is in 1813 to his friend Samuel Brown, a doctor, about some thinking he's been doing about lethal drugs. He's talking about some seeds that he's received. And then he talks about the risks of plants that are poisonous versus other properties they may have. And then he says, the most elegant thing of that kind known is a preparation of the Jamestown weed, Datura stramonium, invented by the French in the time of Robespierre. Every man of firmness carried it constantly in his pocket to anticipate the guillotine. It brings on the sleep of death as quietly as fatigue does the ordinary sleep, without the least struggle or motion. Condorcet, who had recourse to it, was found lifeless in his bed a few minutes after his landlady had left him there, and even the slipper which he had observed half suspended on his foot was not shaken off. So Jefferson knew about this. Many of the early Americans knew about these possibilities. Whether they used them ever, we don't quite know. There are some curious events in early history. John Adams and Jefferson, two presidents, both died on the same day.
Right.
It was the 4th of July, 50 years after the signing of the Declaration of Independence. One of them died in Massachusetts and the other in Virginia. There were no cell phones or telegraphs or any way of communication. But that the fact that these two presidents both died on the same day, not just the same ordinary day, the same important anniversary, invites one to ask how that can have happened. So there are many theories. At the time, this was thought to be an act of God in his recognition of the importance of these two figures. You could argue that it was coincidence. Be a little bit of a long-shot coincidence, but not impossible. You could argue that it was induced by their physicians. You could argue that it was self-induced,
yeah.
Because we don't have clear evidence for any of these conjectures. But the point remains that these two presidents died on the same historic anniversary. So would we think differently of Adams and Jefferson if we knew that they had actually taken a medication
that caused their death? Yeah.
Would it make us rethink the history of our tradition in this nation?
There's an interesting sort of counterpoint that you write about related to physician-assisted suicide. One concept comes from Mary Rose Barrington, the parapsychologist, former barrister, who's written in support of I think, as she puts it, or as it's been put, voluntary suicide. She defends this idea of being able to have a planned death to work this all out. That's in one hand. And then on the other hand is said Daniel Callahan, the bioethicist, the American. Would you talk a little bit about that? I think that sort of that point counterpoint in the way we're thinking about it today is really interesting.
Right. This, I think, speaks exactly to our current circumstances. So Callahan's view is that physician-assisted suicide, as he calls it, is wrong, essentially, that it has deleterious effects, that it's wrong. And Mary Rose Barrington, this is before she became a parapsychologist, sees, I think, further into the future. And her argument is that the notion of planned death might well be widespread. Right? This is something that we could all think about as we think about the changing character of the way we think about how we die. And her view really is that planning one's death with sensitivity to the effects on others, it's really, in a way, harking back, I think, to the old Stoic notions of responsibility for how one dies. Right? That was something that was among the things that the wise man does, is to make his own death a matter of both personal responsibility and social responsibility. Not done in haste, not done out of mental illness or depression or any of those things, but reflected upon voluntarily elected end in one's life. That's what she's exploring as a possibility now. Not much of our thinking is there yet. We still think of assisted dying as something that is done in response to difficult circumstances. One is going downhill from a fatal disease, and when the suffering gets to be too much, then you look for a way out. That's not her picture. Her picture is we ought to reflect essentially throughout our lives on how we want our own deaths to go.
Seneca, you mentioned, wrote that every man ought to make his life acceptable to others besides himself, but his death to himself alone. Mm-hmm. That the life you live can be a public matter, mm-hmm. but the death that you mm-hmm. make mm-hmm. is intensely private, I suppose. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering what you make of that way of thinking. We have a Video West series of short documentaries with Gerda Saunders, former teacher at the University of Utah. And we've been having these incredibly fascinating conversations with her because she has progressive dementia. And so she is intent to take her own life when the time has come, at least while she's still lucid, while she's still thinking about it. And one of the things she's thought about is the idea of making the right death. One of the things she said to us in a conversation recently was that every one of us feels there's a certain criteria for a life worth living. And she knows when life is spent. And so she's thinking so much about that. And I wonder, finally, what you think about that.
Well, I take it she means every one of us thinks that there's a certain criterion for a life worth living for ourselves, and that you never impose that on someone else. Different people will make different choices. So I think the choice that she is making is one that we need to respect. It doesn't mean that you'd make it or I'd make it or any other particular person would make it or should make it, but it's the right death for her, right? She presumably knows what the end stages of Alzheimer's or whatever dementia it is can be like. Sometimes it's benign, smiley. Other times it is marred by suspicion and fear and so on. This is a disease with plenty of antecedent warning, plenty of time to think through how you personally would like your death to go and when in that sequence of what may be a decade or more, when you'd like it to be. One thing that we don't have very well available to us is much in the way of advice about where, if your decision were to end your life in preference to going all the way through the full course of Alzheimer's, where it might be reasonable to do that. Would it be in the early stages? Would it be somewhere about midway? Although that's where you begin to lose capacity for doing that. Would it be the very end stages in which you would be completely incapable of doing that? But advice, experience, right? Not very available. And because it's such a major social issue, that's a kind of advice I think that she will be providing with this interview, right? Here's her thinking about her own death. The character of our deaths is now so extended that I think we are beginning to recognize that that's not fully desirable for many people. That doesn't mean that some people won't want to try to keep going until the bitter end,
sure.
And there are always surprises. But it does mean that many people decline further treatment in the interests of dying sooner but more easily. As we move into a phase in which that becomes a cultural norm, what kinds of information do we want? How do we make those choices, right? What considerations are relevant? What support is available without being controlling?
Can this be abused in some way?
Can it be abused, right? Can what begins as an option become an expectation? But I think the cultural expectations are traveling a little bit behind. They seem to be evolving. We already do this. DNR orders the use of opioids that may shorten life, refusing food, fluid and nutrition and hydration. All those things are part of the scene now.
Yeah.
After all, in the U.S., with the coming into force of the California End-of-Life Options Act, 1 in 10 people in this country will be covered by laws like this. 1 in 10 people, right? And I think it's likely that other states will follow behind, despite the opposition of some groups.
Utah deferred for now, I suppose.
Utah deferred for now, but that bill is not dead. It's the Utah End-of-Life Options Act, and it's a bill with extremely rigorous safeguards. It's a bill modeled on the Oregon Death with Dignity Act and copied essentially by Washington State, by Vermont, and now California. Furthermore, Canada's Supreme Court ruled unanimously that the provinces must develop procedures for allowing aid in dying. This is a global phenomenon. It's especially pronounced in the developed countries because they're the ones with the best developed healthcare systems and the longest life expectancy. It's an issue that comes with, you might say, health luxury. We have very ample healthcare systems. Not everybody has access to them, but of those who do,
it's a luxury to be able to make these decisions.
It's a luxury to be able to make these decisions.
So, but you see that while this arc is, it's a long arc, you do see it bending towards some trajectory that you think that we're headed somewhere, you think?
I think we have to be headed somewhere because I think our current position, no, we can't do this, or we can only do it in the most indirect ways. It's not that we don't shorten life. But we do it by refusing treatment, discontinuing treatment, not offering treatment, using, as I said, opioids that may shorten life, the morphine drip. Those things are all less well protected. Terminal sedation, or it's called deep palliative sedation, Those things are all way less well protected than this much more active choice of ending life. So in the areas that have death with dignity statutes, right, there's a whole set of protections, of safeguards. At least two oral requests 15 days apart, a written request, second or third physician consultation required, consultation with a psychologist or psychiatrist if there's any concern about mental function. And you have to be a competent adult and a resident of the state. All that is part of those statutes. None of that's true for the other ways we die. The medical establishment is in enough of a box, seeing that indefinite aggressive prolongation of life is often undesirable and often cruel. Patients and their physicians look for ways to not have to do that. But under the assumption that taking any overtly active actions towards producing death can't be tolerated, I think that will change. But it has to change so that it's in the hands of the patients.
It's Professor Margaret Pabst Batten. Her most recent book is The Ethics of Suicide, Historical Sources. And I'll mention again that today on Video West, we're premiering the second in a series of short films with Herda Saunders of Salt Lake City. Herda has been diagnosed with a form of progressive dementia, and in the film called The Body That Is Left, she talks about her own plans for an assisted suicide. You can see it at videowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Susan Anderson and Sophie Sirois. We have technical direction from Tim Slover. Video West is produced by Josh Weathers. Radio West, produced by Benjamin Bombard, Annie Lynn Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.